I don't know about you, but it feels like a lot of my friends are now getting on that baby train. If you have a friend who is also expecting or have little ones still in diapers, I always recommend Pampers Swaddlers. With Pampers Swaddlers, you can also rest assured that this diaper will prevent up to 100% of leaks, even blowouts. Swaddlers has dual leak guard barriers at the legs to help protect where leaks happen most, and they have a blowout barrier, which is an innovative back pocket built into the diaper to help prevent those messy leaks up the back. Did you know that on average, babies will use up to 8,000 plus diapers before becoming potty trained? That is a lot. That's why Pampers Diaper Stash is the hottest baby gift for 2024. So give a gift to a loved one that says, "We see you and we've got you." Pampers Diaper Stash is an online diaper fund that all parents with little ones will love. You can organize friends and family to contribute to a group gift of an online stockpile that never has to run out. Pampers Diaper Stash is great because it takes the guesswork out of choosing what size and how many diapers to gift. It's so easy to do, and it's the gift that always fits.
Welcome to ABG, Asian Boss Girl, a podcast for the modern day Asian American woman. I'm Janet.
I'm Helen.
I'm Mel.
And I'm Hesu.
Mental health is a topic that we get many messages about from our listeners. It's a sensitive and complicated topic, and especially with all the recent world events that have occurred, we thought now is the right time to take a deeper dive into this topic. Back in July 2019, we released episode 44, Mental Health with Christine Chen, where our good friend shared her personal experience with clinical depression.
Today, we wanted to offer a different perspective on the topic by bringing in Hesu Jo, a licensed marriage and family therapist based in the Bay Area, California. Hesu has 7 years of experience as a mental health professional, including working with Asian American youth, families, and adults. Given her firsthand experience dealing with generational and cultural differences in her own family, Hesu is also the clinical support lead at BetterHelp, the largest online counseling platform worldwide, whom we've recently started partnering with. And after this episode, if you are curious, you can go to our show notes for a link to sign up with a special discount.
Let's welcome Hesu to the Asian Boss Girl podcast.
Welcome.
Woo!
Welcome.
Wow, thank you so much for such a nice introduction.
Janet does a really good job with that. Can you share a little bit about your, you know, your family and how you grew up, just to give our listeners some context?
Yeah, sure. So my parents are originally from South Korea, and they came to the States in 1980, and they originally came here just to study. They came here for grad school. They had every intention of going back to Korea once they were done with school, so they don't have this typical immigrant story of coming here for opportunity and a better life, because I think they were fortunate enough to come from pretty good families back in Korea, so they didn't have a reason to leave. Mm-hmm. But you know how life happens, right? So once they were in school, they had been married already, and my mom got pregnant with my older sister, and so my dad had this motivation to get done with school a little bit faster to start providing for this new growing family. And so he was able to get pretty good employment, and things kept going in that good direction for him in terms of his career track. And then I came along, and we were still here. And I think at that point, they were still planning to go back eventually someday. But by the time my sister and I had grown into talking, walking people with friends and communities built around us, I think the idea of plucking us out of this country and taking us to somewhere that was foreign to us was really freaky. And so my sister and I were really resistant to it. This was when I was in kindergarten, she was in fifth grade. And so I think at that time, it was then decided, like, I guess America is truly our home now, which it always was to me and my sister. So I was raised by Korean immigrants with a atypical immigration story. They really instilled a lot of traditional Korean values into us. They taught us the language. I grew up eating Korean food every day. So inside my home, there was a lot of like decor that was pretty reflective of what a home might look like in Korea. But at the same time, both of my parents are actually professors. So I think their career tracks, having been exposed to a lot of people in this Western world and having to speak English every day, made them come to a point where they like assimilated a little bit more than some of the parents of my friends. And they also were able to pick up the language pretty quickly. So they are pretty fluent in English. So while I was raised like super Korean in some ways, my parents are also very progressive in a lot of other ways, simply because of like who their colleagues are and being exposed to students year after year as professors. And I grew up in San Jose in California. San Jose is pretty big, so I grew up in an enclave of San Jose where there's a lot of Asian people, but most of those Asian people that I grew up with are Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. So I do consider that kind of like part of my own personal heritage and cultural background, having grown up eating a lot of Vietnamese food, being invited to friends' family parties and different traditional gatherings that they have. There's also a lot of like Latinos in the area that I grew up in, and actually not that many white people. So I think I grew up in this weird little bubble, not understanding that this is not reflective of the rest of the country.
No, I could totally relate to you. I actually grew up in Union Cities.
Oh, okay.
So my dad works in San Jose, so I'm very familiar with like there's so many amazing Vietnamese food, and like my college roommates are also from the area. So I feel like a very part of their like cultural gatherings as well. So it sounds very familiar what you're talking about in terms of San Jose, like growing up there.
Yeah. So it was like a nice thing to have familiarity in terms of other Asian people around me. But at the same time, I think I also grew up feeling very othered because I really didn't know that many other Korean kids until like college. I went to UCLA where I met like tons of Korean people, and I kind of had a culture shock being around so many people that had a lot of similarities in terms of like sense of humor and different family dynamics that they could understand. And I at that point felt like, oh, I met all these people that I don't really have to explain myself to. So that was a different and novel but also like comforting experience. So I think in a nutshell, that's essentially how I grew up, where I grew up.
What did you major in at UCLA?
So I went in undeclared, not really knowing what I wanted to do. And I think I've noticed this trend, right? Like if you're raised by parents that are doing pretty well for themselves, meaning I grew up pretty privileged, I never had this like strong drive to find a really good career, to make a lot of money. It was more my parents being supportive of, you should follow your passions. And of course, we want you to find something that's going to lead to financial stability, but it's not the most important thing for you to become a doctor or a lawyer. So that's another different kind of experience that I had from a lot of my other friends whose parents did struggle with money. And so that was a driving factor in terms of career choice for a lot of my close friends. So I went in undeclared, not really knowing what I wanted to do with my life. And I didn't feel like I wanted to choose a major based on a career, because that was advice from my dad. You know, my dad works in finance now, and he majored in Chinese literature. It's like a whole other thing.
Wow.
But because he had that experience, he really let me and my sister know that we should follow the things that we are interested in, because career stuff kind of falls into place after that, and college should be a time to enlighten yourself, enjoy the privilege of being educated. And even though he said all that stuff, it took me a while to figure out what I wanted to do. I've always been interested in like the motivation of behavior, why people do things the way that they do, think the way that they think, and then behave based on like the feelings that they have. Mm-hmm. And so what better place to kind of study all those interests than psychology? So I did major in psychology in undergrad at UCLA. And so that's where I started getting my first early exposures to this world that has become my livelihood.
How did you get into the work of therapy afterwards?
It's a great question. It was never truly like a career pursuit. I don't think I was ever a small child thinking like, I'm going to grow up to be a therapist. It was more doing that thing that my parents had advised of, follow your dreams, like follow the things that interest you, but also keep it practical. So that's kind of where they were, like finding this balance of it all. And so like every chapter of my life, I feel like I was doing things that felt right for me. And if I found myself in a place where it didn't feel right for me, I would scaffold and kind of try to shape the direction of my life into something that felt better.
Mm-hmm.
I actually majored in psychology thinking that I was going to go into marketing.
Mm.
I don't know. It was probably influenced by movies. I grew up watching a ton of movies because my parents worked a lot. So I was kind of this latchkey kid raised by the third parent of television. And there was this movie with Mel Gibson called What Women Want. It's so random and weird. But he's like this guy that works in advertising and marketing. And I thought that was so cool. And so based on that, I was like, I'm going to go to school to study human behavior and the mind. Because if I understand where people are coming from, I can understand how to make really good commercials to make them buy stuff. But of course, that's like kind of an unorthodox route to go into marketing. But I tried to do that anyway. One of my first jobs in the marketing space was at Adidas. I tried that for a while and it did not resonate with whatever my internal values were. It didn't feel like this is what I want to spend the rest of my life doing, like promoting something that to a lot of people is very important. But at the time it was like, do I want to spend most of my waking hours working towards clothes and making famous people more famous and like that kind of stuff? So that's where I was kind of feeling like I want to do something that's more helpful to people. I think if you talk to any therapist, I would imagine most of them would say that it started at an early age, that they were the friend that their friends would go to, that they are the person that people sought out for a shoulder to lean on or an ear to listen, and often like some kind of grounded advice that felt good for this person to hear. So I decided to leave Adidas and look for jobs in the psychology space because I figured like, let's use my education for something around helping people. And I really didn't have a lot of knowledge of what therapy was. And this kind of goes back to a cultural upbringing of my own. It's like, I don't think a lot of Asian families are talking about therapy or even talking about the things that lead to someone needing to seek it out. If you're having mental and emotional struggle or pain, I think a lot of Eastern cultures are going to focus on like working on that privately. It's a family matter. It's not something that you should be talking to strangers about. Not that that's wrong. It's like a different way to look at everything. But because of that kind of frame of reference that I think my parents had, like, I don't think they knew what therapy was. So it's not something that I knew existed. But just like looking on Craigslist and Indeed and like all these early sites to find a job, I was just searching like, what can I find as a person with a bachelor's in psychology? And so I started doing a lot of things here and there. I worked in a research lab for PhD students that were doing therapy for clients of their own. I worked in school settings and in day treatment facilities, working with kids on the spectrum or with special needs. And so this kind of opened the door to meeting a bunch of other people and professionals in this space that have different kind of licenses. And I met someone that was a therapist, and she kind of told me about what the track looks like to get there. And so that's what I started working towards at that time. So in a nutshell, that's kind of how I got to where I am today.
I think something that you had just mentioned earlier that I want to ask a little bit more on, and something that I really hope that we can eradicate one day, is just how mental health is such a taboo topic in Asian culture. Why do you think that is the case? I mean, you mentioned that your parents kind of just never went through therapy, so they might not know even how to address it. But it's such like a forbidden topic within Asian culture. Yeah. Why do you think that's the case?
The idea of therapy, or just like the practice of it, is very Western. It originates in like European countries, and most of the founding fathers of psychology are old white dudes. The field itself like comes from somewhere very far away from like my parents, most people of East Asian cultures especially. So I think some of the reasons why it's very taboo to even talk about mental and emotional struggle is because of this collectivistic nature of the cultures there. You're very much a representation of your family, and the way that you behave and the way that you present yourself to the outward world is very much a reflection of how your parents raised you. And so parents in a lot of East Asian cultures will take responsibility for the kid's mistake or the kid's error in some kind of treatment to other people or how they perform in school. Even illness is looked at as the mom's fault sometimes. Like, mom didn't take care of this kid well enough, and so now she is sick. And so because of that, I think it could be, you know, taboo to talk about this stuff because you don't want to bring shame and all this stuff to your family, and your family doesn't want to talk about it because they don't want other people to think that they did something wrong. So I think that's at least some part of it. I do know that the study of psychology and the treatment form of therapy is becoming more accepted and more of a thing in a lot of East Asian countries and Asian in general, but it's still like worlds away from where we are in America, where it's pretty trendy to have a therapist. And you know, there's memes about it. There's like a bunch of stuff online about being very open about being depressed and having anxiety.
I myself have a therapist, and it took a lot of getting over this feeling of shame that you were talking about too. That's kind of just inherent within our culture to not go out and seek help, right? Do you have any examples of patients you've worked with? And of course, respecting their privacy, but examples of scenarios where culture was a strong influence in whatever issue or issues they were trying to work through?
On the kind of macro level, I have worked with clients of many different kinds of Asian descent. So like Filipino, Korean, Vietnamese, Taiwanese, people whose parents are from mainland China. I think that's pretty much the extent of the clients that I have worked with. And I can't say that any of them had something come up in the therapeutic process that wasn't connected to their family and the cultural upbringing and their background. I've even worked with people that are third generation, meaning it was their grandparents that immigrated here, and it's still passed into those generations beyond. Like, These clients didn't even speak the language of their grandparents, and yet they still felt some of the cultural pressures related to stigma when it comes to talking about their mental health and looking for help for it. And so some of the specific examples, I would say, it's interesting. I mean, I've never worked actually with very young children of Asian descent, and I think that's the landscape of that is changing now. But when I was working with kids, which most therapists do during the internship hours and before getting their license, you work with a lot of children, and I really didn't see that many kids of Asian descent come through these clinics that I worked at. And I think it's partially related to everything that we just talked about and a lot of families being unwilling to look for that kind of support. Again, I think the landscape is quickly evolving, so that's great. So most of the Asian clientele that I've worked with have been young adults, and these are adults often that have come in letting me know that their families don't know that they're doing this, that if they were to try to explain to the parents that they were seeking out some kind of mental or emotional support, they might get some kind of pushback from the family or even resistance, maybe encouragement to stop. That's kind of some of the specific examples because it's thematic, right? It's happened more than once.
So of these patients that you're seeing who are of Asian descent, are there patterns that you see of kind of more prominent mental health struggles? And then maybe looking at females versus males, are there kind of like ones that are more prominent between one gender or the other and with a cultural background?
The prominent themes of anxiety, depression, and loneliness are pretty common across cultures. But I do think it manifests kind of differently in a lot of the Asian American clients that I've worked with because of this experience of not really being able to be open about it with their families or some of their very close friends even. It's interesting because I think we can be open with our friends, but people are scared to bring it up first sometimes. So some of the themes I've seen in, let's start with the Asian American woman, because all of us are that. I think a lot of my clients have expressed feeling like they've been socialized and raised and pressured to become a good wife and a good mother. These are often on top of the list of like this trajectory of life that's supposed to be. So there's a lot of different mental and emotional struggles that come with that kind of expectation on people. A lot of questions about identity, like where do I find myself and how do I address my personal needs while also attending to the things that my parents are looking for, because for whatever reason, we're all probably looking to at least make them somewhat happy, whatever happiness even means. And that's kind of a convoluted thing too. I've heard several clients talk about not being exactly sure about how to define happiness and having had experiences with parents saying life isn't about chasing happiness, which is a very Western idea. In terms of some of the Asian American male clients I've worked with, I think I'd be probably not surprised to learn that the issues that Asian American men experience look pretty different than maybe some mental or emotional struggles that men in Asia experience, simply because of this experience in the United States, especially, and just in like Western media, all this kind of stuff. Asian men are kind of painted and portrayed in a certain way that they're not super manly or macho or like whatever that means. Whereas Asian men that grow up in Asia, they're not othered in this way. They are just men. So this is an assumption on my part because obviously I haven't had any clients that are just Asian men from Asia. So I don't know what it is like for them exactly. But I have seen a lot of Asian American men that have a lot of insecurities about identity, even if they're not really presenting that way in their like professional space or with their friends and their family. But it's something that does come up in therapy if they even come to therapy. I will say I haven't worked with a lot of Asian American men in therapy, and I think it's just because they're less likely to seek it out than Asian American women right now. That's at least in my experience. And it could be because I'm a woman too. It could be that if there are Asian American men looking for therapy, they might be looking for a male therapist. So there's a bunch of stuff to consider when it comes to that.
So you've talked a little bit about depression and anxiety being the very prominent issues that you see people struggle with Asian descent, and then also maybe within our generation. If you could share with our listeners kind of like mental health 101, how would you kind of define some of these symptoms to recognize anxiety and then similarly depression?
Sure. So anxiety is more or less an emotion, right? It's something that we feel very internally. And it's very future oriented. So it's something that we experience when we're worried. For example, we might notice some kind of tension or internal turmoil about something that hasn't happened yet. It may or may not even happen, but anxiety pretty much manifests when something in the future is bothering us in some kind of way. Like inside, we feel just uncomfortable and kind of restless, even some of the physiological symptoms. So that's just like, what is your body going through that you can notice to see that you're probably experiencing some of this is like sweatiness, perspiration, increased heart rate, probably higher blood pressure, which isn't always something that you can feel, gastrointestinal discomfort. So just like bubble gut, having to go to the bathroom is pretty common, maybe cold hands and feet. And there are reasons behind all of this. In undergrad, I did study a lot of evolutionary psychology. So that's just looking at human behavior in terms of how this was some kind of adaptation to help us survive. So I do look at anxiety as a mechanism that made its way through evolution and continues to be with us because it's a tool that we use to survive, right? So the perspiration comes from our body proactively trying to regulate temperature before we're about to exert a lot of energy to do something big. That's the same thing with the racing heart. Your heart is prioritizing blood to certain areas like your bigger muscle groups, your legs and your arms. Mm-hmm. And that's why your fingers and your toes might feel really cold when you're anxious, because your body isn't focusing on sending a lot of blood to these fine motor skill areas of your body. Rather, you're getting ready to fight something like punch a bear or like run away from some kind of creature that's trying to attack you. The problem is, like, I think society and culture has evolved way more quickly than our bodies have. So we still have all these internal mechanisms to help us survive in the jungle or in the desert. Mm-hmm. But now we just kind of sit there at our desks and have all this stuff like pent up. And those are some of the things you can notice and experience when you are anxious.
That's so interesting. It's like when I'm going up on stage to speak, it's like, I'm not fighting a bear. I'm just going up on stage to speak. But I feel all of those symptoms.
Exactly. Because I read something like 75% of US adults surveyed. I don't know how many people were surveyed, but it said like 75% of us experience some kind of performance anxiety when it comes to speaking in front of other people. Mm-hmm. And anxiety is also provoked when our body is perceiving some kind of threat, right? We're talking about this danger that you're trying to get away from. And it's scary to be in front of a whole bunch of people that could judge you, that could make all these assumptions about who you are and your character, especially if you mess up when you're up there. So it makes sense to be scared of this stuff. And so when we're scared, we often get very anxious because it's about the unknown of the future. Mm. When it comes to depression, sometimes it's a chemical imbalance in your brain. I think a lot of us have heard that, and this is why a lot of psychotropic medication can be effective. Sometimes it's a mood that's just triggered by thoughts or some kind of event or series of events in life. Sometimes it's all of the above. People with depression are going to experience this like persistent and ongoing feeling of sadness. They might experience a loss of interest in all things, especially things that they used to enjoy. And this loss of interest in stuff is referred to as anhedonia. There's also going to be this lack of drive or motivation or willingness to even care about doing anything. So I think a lot of us can have this picture of what it looks like to be a depressed person because we've seen it in movies and in TV. We've probably even seen it in our friends and in ourselves, if not our family members too. But it's someone that just has a hard time, for example, getting out of bed and motivating themselves to brush their teeth and take a shower, do their laundry, like take care of themselves, because it could feel like life isn't really worth living anymore. And if you're someone that's no longer experiencing joy or anything in life to be exciting or novel anymore, it makes sense to feel like there really isn't anything to live for, because those positive feelings are very much, I think, what gives us reasons to live, like really beautiful reasons to live. And so when someone's not seeing or experiencing that stuff, of course they would feel persistently sad. I think other depressed people might say it's not just about feeling sad, but also hollow or empty. Sometimes there's feelings of hopelessness that things will never get better. And on the flip side, depression can manifest as a lot of irritability, frustration, and anger. So you see this more in like teens and sometimes even people that aren't super in touch with their feelings. They just kind of lash out in angry bursts, and it could just be because they're depressed. You're also probably gonna have disturbances to your sleep patterns, whether that's you're sleeping way more than often or you can't sleep at all. This is all a sign of depression. And with those sleep disturbances, you're probably going to be really fatigued at times and have a lack of energy. Your appetite can get messed up, meaning you might be eating way more than you need to, or you're not motivated to eat at all. Mm-hmm. So it can go in either direction. So any kind of significant changes in weight is something that a therapist is probably going to assess for. Oftentimes when you are depressed, you're also probably experiencing anxiety. There is an unfortunate friendship between these two things, and they often come together. In that situation where you're experiencing both, it can be really uncomfortable because you're trapped, right? You're like restless because of the anxiety, but you're not motivated to do anything about it because you're so depressed. So you're just a kind of a prisoner of your own mind. And I think other things that come to mind are like feelings of worthlessness, and then feeling guilty that you can't get yourself to do anything. And then shame is another feeling that accompanies being depressed, because I think a lot of people live with this idea that it's like, I'm weak and I can't get myself to get better. Why is it that other people are out there succeeding at their careers and having good relationships? They're making their marriages work. Like, what is wrong with me? And so guilt and shame becomes a huge thing. I think that those with depression struggle with also. Of course, on the extreme side of it is when you are now experiencing suicidal ideation, you might be even making plans or just like kind of ruminating on how you would do it, how you would end your life. You might hear about possible side effects of different antidepressants, and a lot of times they say it may increase your suicidal ideation. And I think a lot of people are very confused when they hear that. It's because part of what the medication is doing is it's increasing your activity level and your energy level and your motivation to do stuff. You've been so depressed, so you couldn't even plan to do something, but now that the medication is increasing this like active energy, now you have like more energy to think about how you would end up killing yourself. So that's a strange and scary thing to consider when taking antidepressants. And then finally, I want to bring it back to this topic of being Asian, because I think it is important to hear this too for a lot of the listeners that are Asian American. Mm-hmm. Depression can manifest differently in Asian people, and this has been found in a lot of different research studies. It's been replicated, and I've seen it myself in family members and in clients. For whatever reason, a lot of times depression can manifest in somatic symptoms. So somatic symptoms is just referring to things that you feel in your body. So a lot of Asian clients may complain of back pain or headaches tension in their neck. And that could be an indication that they're actually struggling really hard with an emotional or mental problem.
Yeah, that's interesting you bring that up, because like my mom and I've been talking, because my grandpa has like, he's one of the most healthiest like older man you could probably find in your life. He like used to walk every day and all this stuff, but then we went back to Taiwan and saw him, like now he walks with a cane. And my mom was like, I actually think your grandpa's depressed, because a lot of his friends have passed away, and like he's not moving as much anymore, and he like blames a lot of things. He's like, there's something wrong with my legs or something, there's always something wrong. And he goes to the doctor almost every week because he's like, he needs to solve this issue. But my mom's like, I don't think it's a physical issue, it's a mental issue at this point. Mm-hmm. But people at that age don't really understand like mental health isn't a thing they actually talk about or like are okay addressing, because you're like, they're so old, right? And I think it is part of the Asian culture. So as you're saying this, I'm just like, oh, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a prevailing stereotype that Asian women all have stick straight jet black hair, but that's just not the case. One of the main points we make on this podcast is how, even though we are all Asian American women, we are all really different, and that goes for our hair too. Janet has short, dark, but not quite black straight hair. Mel has thick, somewhat wavy brown hair with golden highlights. And me, I have long, gray blonde, textured hair.
Function of Beauty formulates every bottle based on our unique hair types and hair goals. They gather your information through a quiz, and you can customize with the fragrance and color. The last part, which we had a lot of fun with, was adding your name to be printed on the bottle. So we went with our nicknames for each other: Woo Woo, Mel Mel, and Jan Jan.
They are vegan, cruelty-free, and never use sulfites, parabens, phthalates, or mineral oils. They are offering our listeners a savings of 20% on your first purchase. Go to functionofbeauty.com/ABG to take your 4-part hair profile quiz and save 20% on your first order. Don't spend another minute in hair misery. Go to functionofbeauty.com/ABG to let them know that we sent you. That's functionofbeauty.com/ABG.
Hey y'all, since we've all been social distancing ourselves, there's been a little more wine activity in some of our homes, and we wanted to introduce you to Pure Wine.
Pure Wine offers two unique products, the Wand, which filters wine by the glass, and the Wave, which filters and aerates a full bottle. Pure Wine filters work on all varieties of wine without affecting the natural taste, aroma, or color.
Whether you experience headaches, congestion, skin flush, upset stomach, or hangovers, Pure Wine is the solution for you. Stock up on Pure Wine like you do those wine bottles. Use the promo code CORK20 to get 20% off your next purchase at drinkpurewine.com.
I don't know about you, but it feels like a lot of my friends are now getting on that baby train. If you have a friend who is also expecting or have little ones still in diapers, I always recommend Pampers Swaddlers. With Pampers Swaddlers, you can also rest assured that this diaper will prevent up to 100% of leaks, even blowouts. Swaddlers has dual leak guard barriers at the legs to help protect where leaks happen most. And they have a blowout barrier, which is an innovative back pocket built into the diaper to help prevent those messy leaks up the back. Did you know that on average, babies will use up to 8,000 plus diapers before becoming potty trained? That is a lot. That's why Pampers Diaper Stash is the hottest baby gift for 2024. So give a gift to a loved one that says, "We see you and we've got you." Pampers Diaper Stash is an online diaper fund that all parents with little ones will love. You can organize friends and family to contribute to a group gift of an online stockpile that never has to run out. Pampers Diaper Stash is great because it takes the guesswork out of choosing what size and how many diapers to gift. It's so easy to do, and it's the gift that always fits.
I shared on the previous episodes, like, I deal with anxiety a lot, and it's gotten a lot worse into my adulthood. And so I turned to things like meditation to kind of, like, temper it. But it wasn't until that, like, I actually got a panic attack that I talked to my doctor, and she was like, maybe you should see a therapist. So, like, I know a lot of people right now, like, we're getting a lot of DMs asking, like, you know, when did you know it was the right time to seek therapy? Like, for me, I had to, like, reach a panic attack to seek therapy. Like, in your personal opinion, like, when do you think it's the right time to actually look for a therapist?
I mean, I'm sorry that you are going through that. That sounds so difficult. This path of action of going to see a therapist because you've now had a panic attack, it's reminding me of how a lot of Asian people approach medical care too. It's like, well, I'm not going to go to the doctor unless I'm dying. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's good self-care to go to the doctor at least once a year for a physical checkup, to be proactive and preventative about your physical health. And so I want to say the same thing about your mental health. I don't think there's ever a wrong time to go see a therapist. Obviously, it's going to be limited based on, like, your health insurance, for example, if you want to go that route. If you have subsidized health insurance, for example, most of the time you have to go through an evaluation and an assessment, and the therapist has to determine that you meet medical necessity, meaning you kind of have to be sick enough to get these services that are being paid for by the state or, you know, at the federal level too. But when it comes to being considerate of yourself and wanting to invest something into your overall wellness, I don't think that there's ever a wrong time to consider seeing somebody. Mm. I think it's part of the human condition to have a lot of internal strife when it comes to identity, when it comes to feeling like you're in your place in the world and like things are all good. I don't think anybody is 100% there. And because I think life is a journey of constant self-improvement, having room to get to know yourself better in the context of relationship, but also in just being comfortable with who you are and being secure and confident in all that. So obviously when you break a bone, you want to go see a doctor. So if you've had a panic attack or if you're noticing frequent and chronic sadness, suicidal ideation, these are obviously times that you should seriously consider seeing somebody or talking to somebody. But at the same time, like, if you've gone through some kind of adjustment, this is actually a huge trigger for all of us to go through a variety of symptoms of anxiety and depression. Is like you've had a change in your job, or you've moved, or you've lost a friend, or some kind of other change has happened. That's often a good time to consider talking to somebody, because you might not even know what's going on with you and you just kind of feel out of it.
Mm-hmm. I think as I entered, like, you know, seeking a therapist, like, I have, I guess, two questions. Like, how do you recommend our listeners to go find a therapist? And, like, mm-hmm. there's so many different types of, like, mental health professionals, such as, like, a psychiatrist, a counselor. So I guess, like, what is the difference and how do you know who to look for?
Right. So first I'll talk on some of the differences and then we can talk about how to find them. So a psychiatrist specifically is a medical doctor. This is someone that went to med school and then they specialized in psychiatry, right? It's a pretty interesting field in and of itself because these people are doctors, they're physicians by nature, and then they specialized in something like a oncologist or an OBGYN or someone like that. It's just a specialty. And so psychiatrist is who you would go to if you need medication. And psychiatrist is often who your talk therapist will refer you to if the talk therapist thinks that you might benefit from medication or at least a consultation about that. So medication can be prescribed if you're having really, really hard time managing depression symptoms or even anxiety. The other thing, so there's like so many different license types out there that it can be quite overwhelming and it can feel confusing. And like, what am I supposed to look for? Does it depend on what kind of problem I'm having? What if I'm having so many different kinds of problems? Do I then need 10 therapists? And really, there's this term called psychotherapist, which is used pretty broadly, and it covers a lot of different license types. And depending on the state, too, there's also different licenses, and that's a whole other thing. But there's licensed marriage and family therapists, which is what license I have. And so the focus on my education and training was very much about looking at the person in the context of relationship. So whether that's in their marriage or relationship or with their family, I'm constantly conceptualizing my clients as people that are part of a system of other people. That's actually a good time to consider talking to someone, is when you notice that your relationships are struggling in some kind of way. You might be noticing that you've pushed people away, or it feels like nobody wants to be around you, or you're constantly getting into arguments with people that are important to you. That could be a good sign that something is going on. Yeah. And then there's also LCSWs, which are licensed clinical social workers. They have a background in training in social work, obviously, but they're also trained to do individual therapy with you, family therapy. I do believe some do couples counseling also. There's different like licensed professional clinical counselors, licensed mental health counselors, and then there's also clinical psychologists. So before it's a clinical psychologist, all those licenses I mentioned, most of them have the educational requirement of having a master's in some kind of counseling field or psychology, social work, something like that. Clinical psychologists have a doctorate, and it could be a PhD or a PsyD. So PsyD is a doctorate of psychology. PhD is very research focused. So you're probably working in a lab somewhere gathering a bunch of data, where PsyD is more focused on the practice of therapy. All this to say, like, all of these people are qualified to be your therapist, regardless of what your issue is. I think there is kind of some understanding that if you're having a severe mental disorder, you're probably going to want to look for a clinical psychologist that can do a full assessment and evaluation of what's going on. But anxiety, depression, adjustment issues, challenges at work, issues with relationships, problems coming up with your mood, like any of these kinds of therapists are somebody that you can look for and talk to. In terms of how to find them, it can be very overwhelming. Yeah. There are big directories online now that exist that make it slightly easier. So some of the things that coming to my mind right now are like opencounseling.com, psychologytoday.com. These are big directories that you can search based on, I think you can enter like your zip code to see who's available in your local area. I don't know if it actually filters by availability, but you'll be able to see therapists who've listed themselves, and you can call them to see if they have openings. You can also start, if you have health insurance, you can start with your health insurance panel to see a list of people that are part of it, meaning they accept your insurance. And whether that's they bill your insurance directly, or you can get a bill from them to submit to your insurance provider for a claim for reimbursement. Those are a few ways.
I had a question about that, because I know we actually got recently a DM from someone that's asking about therapy, because she was like, I'm a college student, like, you know, what is like the typical rate? Because, you know, I don't know if I could afford to have a therapist. So like, I guess like from your experience, like I know some therapists do like sliding scales, but what's a typical rate, I guess, for therapy?
So that also depends on like how you found this person. So often if you're going through your insurance, you'll usually have a copay of anywhere from like $20 to $50 ish. If you're going to someone in private practice that, for example, does not take insurance, which this exists too, you're looking at anywhere from like $150 to upwards of like $300 an hour, I've heard. And so it can be a little, like, quite pricey at the end of the day. Yeah. There's also a lot of barriers to this, I've heard, and experience too. It's not easy to find a therapist. You can go to this gigantic directory, look for all these people, like come up with a list of 10 people that look like somebody you want to work with. You call all of them, get a bunch of voicemails, and then you get callbacks saying that they're not taking clients right now. Or, yeah, I can get you in for a next appointment in 6 weeks. So I've heard a lot of people like having to wait for a really long time, or just not having luck finding somebody very quickly or efficiently. Yeah. So another option to consider that helps try to address some of these barriers that do exist is online counseling. And that is the space that I'm currently working in. Most of the online counseling platforms have tried to address some of this stuff, like whether it's difficulties with managing your HMO or PPO and your insurance provider, or if it's because availability issues. With online counseling, it's all remote, so you don't have to go into an office, so that eliminates the need of having somebody that's in the same zip code of you. Mm-hmm. You generally will be good in terms of that, because there's actually thousands of therapists in this country. It's just a matter of matching those people's experiences with a client that has those kinds of needs, and it could be that somebody's in Northern California working with a therapist in Southern California. So online counseling can be helpful in that way.
And I have a question too. I feel like a lot of people struggle with getting good therapists through their insurance. Is there a reason why that's the case? I know a lot of like specialty therapists won't take insurance.
I mean, like, therapists are human too. And when you're part of an insurance panel, it can be kind of a headache to go through and make sure that you get paid for the services that you've provided. So once a lot of private practice therapists have gotten to a certain point in their career, they just don't want to bother with the paperwork anymore. And so it's I'm in demand. People are going to pay for these sessions whether I accept their insurance or not. So I'm just going to not do that anymore. Especially if you're a specialist, you're definitely going to be somebody that people look for. In terms of this, like, challenge of finding a good therapist, whether that's through your insurance panel or just in general, it comes back to this human piece, is we're still all humans. And in an ideal world, every therapist is trained to be professional enough to work with any kind of client coming in through the door. But it's still very much a human connection. Mm. And there's a relationship involved. And so if you don't click with this person or mesh with this person in the way that feels comfortable with you, it's going to feel really uncomfortable to start diving into some of your deepest and darkest thoughts and feelings. You could have seen a series of therapists that don't feel right, but it's probably not because they're bad therapists. They just weren't right for you. Mm-hmm. And that is part of, I think, the challenge in therapist shopping, is finding someone that feels good. I mean, it's like the same thing in dating, right? It's so hard to find somebody that you click with and mesh with and feels like the right fit.
Yeah.
And I can say the same for looking for friends. You know, as an adult woman, it's hard to find other adult women that you feel comfortable being friends with. So I think it's on the same note as some of that stuff. It's just like this human connection piece of the therapeutic journey is so important.
Yeah.
And it's hard to connect with people, period.
Yeah. And I can't even imagine, like, you as a therapist having to listen to so many stories and almost having this, like, I mean, I don't know if this is bad to say, but like this, like, blanket of like sadness throughout your day, because you have to listen to so many people talk about their struggles, and sometimes it gets really, really like deep too. Do you yourself have a therapist?
I have in the past. I don't presently have one, but it is, I think, extremely important for therapists to be in therapy throughout their careers, whether it's ongoing or here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Because yes, it's emotionally draining, and it brings up a lot of your own personal stuff when your clients are talking about things that are relatable, which a lot of things are, because we're all connected in this interconnected humanity kind of way.
Yeah.
It is actually a requirement for those that are training to become licensed professionals to go into therapy. Because if you're not really sure of yourself, and if you're not good with your own like values, your opinions, your stances and world ideology, that kind of stuff gets really shaken up by the things that your clients bring to you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really important to really have good insight into who you are so that your damaged parts don't bleed into the relationship with your client.
Oof.
That's like an important thing I talk about with those that are considering therapy, is like, we all have wounds inside of us, right? And if we don't do things to heal these wounds, we end up bleeding on other people. It's very important, I think, for therapists to constantly be doing the emotional and mental work required of them to be good, you know, be in a good place.
Doing their own self-work too.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
So, hey, Sue, I've had experiences with seeing a couple of different therapists and kind of the plethora of the different backgrounds, like you mentioned, some that was a PsyD, some that was an LMFT,
mm-hmm.
some that was a psychiatrist. And I feel like generally, like you had mentioned, most people are going to aim for those of a similar either cultural background or gender background. How important do you think it is to look for those things? I've seen both male and female, and one of my ways of thinking was that
A, like you said, it's really hard to find like a good match. So, and even just getting access to someone who maybe has a profile you're looking for, but also accepting new patients. But also I thought maybe if I see someone who is really different than me, they might be able to offer an alternative perspective that I hadn't thought about in some of the things that I'm dealing with.
Yeah.
What would you have to say to kind of maybe some of our listeners who are thinking through the profile of seeking a therapist?
Right. I think that there are definitely pros and cons to the search of someone that's similar to you. I think a lot of prospective clients out there do have this idea that obviously if my therapist is just like me, they're going to get me. They're going to understand me a lot better, and then they're going to help guide me in better ways to self-actualization and healing because they know who I am, because they are who I am. So I see a lot of clients coming through looking for someone that's very similar to who they are. So as an example, you might have a client coming in like, I would like a therapist that identifies as a queer woman of color that grew up in the northern parts of the United States and has experience with incarcerated individuals in their family, like super duper specific, because the client thinks only that kind of person is going to understand me. My hope is that therapists out there have done that emotional and mental work to be in a place that they don't have to be exactly like their clients to be an effective clinician for them. Some of the cons that I can think of is that if you as a therapist are similar seemingly in background to your client, you're running into the danger of making assumptions about the similarities that you have, and you are needing to tread carefully in terms of making those assumptions of thinking that you understand everything about this person because you look like them. At the same time, I think there is a lot of value in looking for a therapist that does have similar background to you, because I've also seen unfortunate situations in which people of color will have a white therapist and they're talking about different family dynamics and things that they've experienced as children, and the therapist pathologizing some of these dynamics and the ways that their parents have treated them, saying that it was abusive, for example, when if you are to look at it in the context of the country where the parent came from, it's socially acceptable there. So then you have a client that's coming out of sessions even more confused about their relationship with their parents. So that's like a weird thing that I've seen kind of happen. So I think there is value in looking for a therapist, especially of color, if you are a person of color, because there are some things that can be addressed in a different kind of way. There's, you know, this risk of like misjoining or not getting the point or making assumptions versus like real firsthand empathy and understanding on a therapist side. Ultimately, I still think it's like an individual thing. It's still going to be based on the person and not so much about whether this person is a woman or a person of color or something like that. And when it comes to the gender thing, it's also very context specific. So transference is the experience of the feelings and thoughts that a client has for their counselor, for their therapist. And so that kind of stuff comes into consideration a lot if the thing that you're coming to therapy about is focused around some kind of relationship that you've had in the past. So for example, you'll see a lot of female clients that refuse to work with male therapists because they've been raped by a man in the past. So that kind of thing can come up. And you'll also see schools of thought thinking like maybe you should see a male therapist so you can have the positive and healing experience of knowing that not all men are out there to hurt you. So it can be very context specific. I've seen and read and experienced and heard of a lot of instances in which people will try to, maybe unconsciously or maybe they're aware of it too, but try to recreate relationships from their life that didn't work out with their therapist. So if somebody had like a missing father in their life, they might actually look for an older male therapist to try to recreate this relationship and experience that they didn't have. And so that's that word transference that I talked about kind of covers all that stuff too, is just the experience of someone with the feelings that they have towards the therapist. And then on the flip side, there's counter transference, which is all the feelings and experiences that the therapist is having about this client, because we're not robots and we are going to have feelings and thoughts about our clients. We're going to love them. We're going to hate them. We're going to think about them, worry about them. And all that stuff can come out in sessions too.
I always tell my therapist, I know you love me, because she can't touch me, so I have to give her a hug, and then she'll be like, okay, I'll give you this hug, but they can't approach me outside in the real world, or there's all of these different things that you wouldn't, you know, think about as
limitations exactly. of what you can or cannot do with your therapist.
And what you're describing, there are like ethical guidelines that exist for therapists. Mm. And these come about for a variety of reasons. But some of the big stuff that I'm thinking of is like, there's an inherent power dynamic, the power differential between therapist and client. The therapist is a person in the position of authority. The client is the one that's extremely vulnerable in this space, opening themselves up for this person to now know everything about them, where you probably don't know that much about your therapist. Mm-hmm. And so because there's this like imbalance in power in the relationship, it's very important for the client to be protected in all ways inside and outside of the therapeutic session. Mm-hmm. So that thing about not touching you and not approaching you in public, it's like the client should never feel cornered or pressured to do anything for the therapist.
Yeah.
If the client wants to approach us, great. And if the client wants to, you know, do something this and that, like, they were never pressured to do that. That's the hope. I'm sure your therapist probably enjoys being with you, and it's not that she doesn't want to hug you, but
my therapist is a tough cookie. She gives me tough love.
For the people who are kind of on the fence of seeking therapy, like, do you have a quick story of like someone who actually benefited, like a progress story from therapy?
I'd like to think all of my clients have made progress. I think people look for this stuff for a variety of reasons, and the two categories I've mostly seen are they're looking to reduce some kind of symptom. So it could be that like their job performance has suffered, their sleep schedule is thrown off, they just don't feel right. So they're trying to get rid of symptoms, right? Or they're coming to therapy looking for increased insight. They want to learn more about themselves and they want to be a better person. So depending on how you're coming to therapy, you kind of work in the beginning stages with your therapist to identify what your concerns are so that you can solidify what your goals are. Because that's like the whole point, is to have some kind of goal to work towards in this relationship and this treatment process. So when it comes to success stories, I'm actually thinking of a past Asian American female client that I've had that came in struggling deeply with social anxiety. So for your listeners that aren't super familiar with what social anxiety is as a mental health disorder, it's not just being nervous around other people, but it's clinical, right? It's when you find yourself completely avoiding social situations, having panic attacks being triggered just by the thought of hanging out with a group of people. It's near impossible to physically get up and do a speech in front of others. You might have a hard time eating in front of other people. It's just like a lot of extreme anxiety in the face of being in front of other people. So she came in with these concerns and we worked together for, I want to say, about 6 months. When it comes to anxiety, there's a lot of concrete skills and tools that your therapist is going to be able to teach you, which is a great thing. When it comes to anxiety, it's a lot of identifying these cognitive distortions that you're experiencing. So things in your mind that are maybe not so rational in terms of your logic or the way that you're thinking, your therapist will help you identify some of these things and replace them with healthier thoughts and things that can help improve your self-image and your sense of self-worth. After about 6 months, she was able to go out, hang out with friends, do speeches in front of people. It was a huge shift just because she was able to start thinking about herself differently and identifying triggers in the world that she could center herself with. Like, meditation is actually a really good thing. And it doesn't just have to be you sitting, you know, cross-legged on the ground and chanting ohms. It's about being in tune with your present moment and living a mindful life. Because when you're in tune with your present moment, then you're not obsessing over the future, which is what anxiety is. Mm. On that note, anxiety is not something that goes away. It's not something that we get rid of in therapy. It's more about learning to manage it and live with it, because anxiety in various levels is actually healthy for us, because it's what helps us plan ahead, make sure that we're taking care of ourselves. It is a survival skill. It's just a matter of harnessing that energy and using it for good versus letting it take over our lives.
Beautifully said. Thank you for that. So I wanted to move into the current state of the world. With everything going on with COVID-19, there is this general global state of anxiety, especially with xenophobia and racism against the Asian community, which is causing a lot of fear, anger, and overall stress. Like, I know for me, I find myself going to go out to get groceries, and I will wear a hat or a cap in a sense, to like hide my face, because I am in this general state of like fear of going out now, right? What would you recommend for our listeners if they are maybe involved in an incident where they're feeling afraid, or even worse, if they get verbally or physically attacked?
You know, I wish I had a very good answer for this, but it's hard to say because admittedly, I've been very afraid too. I've been scared for my parents, for my family, a lot of my friends, some of my clients, and myself. You know, like when I leave my home, I'm also having that internal debate of like, should I wear a mask? Because if I wear a mask, people are going to think I have it. And if I don't wear a mask, they're going to yell at me to wear a mask. I've seen so much stuff online about this stuff. And so here's the human side of me saying, like, I've been anxious about this too. And it's been a lot to process while trying to continue to be a therapist for my clients that are struggling with all the stuff that's going on in terms of impact to people's jobs and their family lives and how they're going to upkeep their everyday lifestyle during all this stuff. So when it comes to someone that is fearful of some kind of discrimination or even someone that's experienced it, I do think it's important to find somebody to process this with. Whether that's a professional or not is totally up to you, because I think this is something that you can find some healing from by just having a sense of community, trying to avoid isolation, which is hard with this period of time, right? It's like we're needing to stay isolated to protect public health at large. So my advice is to use the technology that we have at hand to stay connected with the people that you feel close to so that you're not just holed up alone. Because maintaining this sense of community will also remind you that you're not alone in these struggles and these experiences, and there are people there that want to support you and be there for you. Of course, if you've actually been a victim of one of these unfortunate situations, like depending on the situation, I can't tell you what to do, but my encouragement would be to speak out about it. Like, use whatever platforms you have. If you have people that can speak on it, if it's a crime that needs to be reported, these are things that need to be brought into the light in order for somebody or some entity or some group of people as humanity to address it. Because if you just like hole up and don't say anything about it and do what a lot of us are raised to do and just suck it up and try to move on quietly, it's just going to rot inside of you, I think, and turn into those wounds that will end up bleeding on other people somewhere down the line, whether that's next week or in a few years from now. So I think many people now, especially Asian Americans, are in a position to speak out about this stuff and use the internet as a platform, for example, to bring awareness and attention to the unfortunate situations that are happening. Because even if you're not getting support physically right next to you, you can have the support of a very large community with you. So I think it's just important to bring awareness to the situation and so that it's not ignored or forgotten.
I had a question for that topic too, because like I know you mentioned, like, you know, obviously all of us are in social isolation, and like I think it's really great that we have the platform of, you know, the internet to like, you know, raise awareness. I think for me, like, even though I love social media, that's what I do full-time actually as a job, that I think sometimes what I've noticed, a behavior I'm doing, is like I check my phone every day for the news, and unfortunately all I see is like really, really just sad things about like our friends losing their business due to the coronavirus, or like all these videos like people being racist towards Asian Americans and Asians. And I think to some degree, like, I feel myself like I'm not directly affected by this racism, because like I'm not being, you know, personally racially attacked, but I'm affected by reading and seeing all these like horrendous things are happening around me, to like I feel like I'm kind of like losing myself, or losing like like I feel myself becoming really down. I think one, I feel like a sense of like I'm not doing my part as an Asian American to stand up to people, but at the same time I feel like I can't look at this anymore, because it's just like I don't want to feel myself just unraveling at the same time. I feel like I was talking to another friend who felt the same way, because she was like, I'm on social, but like all I see is sad things, but then how do you expect me to stay connected and feel like not too socially isolated? So I think one thing I'm trying to do, it's not the best, is just like limit my time on my phone. But I don't know if you have any other advice for people, or maybe who are like me, that are affected by these videos or the news articles that aren't necessarily directed to them, but like kind of correlated.
A lot of us are struggling to find the balance in staying informed and knowing what's going on in terms of what are the facts, but also not letting ourselves spiral into panic from all the stimulation and the input that we're getting online. So I think limiting time is pretty important. And that's actually something that I've been needing to do for myself too, is limiting my time of consuming news, whether that's online or some other outlet, to, at least for me, I've been trying to limit to 30 minutes a day because that's when I start noticing my anxiety really spiking if I'm looking at my phone for much longer than that. Because I want to stay informed. I want to know what's going on. I want to keep myself safe in terms of all the guidelines that are being placed by local government and whatnot. But at the same time, it's like you don't want to let yourself go into this black hole of information, especially of stuff that might not be true. And then all the scary stuff that we're seeing that's happening to a lot of Asian Americans. I think what you're describing actually is called vicarious trauma. Mm-hmm. And so this is something that a lot of therapists and caregivers, like healthcare professionals, EMTs, like these kinds of people will experience something called vicarious trauma, which is experiencing the trauma of other people by simply being a witness to it. And so some of the symptoms of having experienced trauma include, you know, just like vigilance and fearfulness, increased anxiety, even some paranoid thoughts can come to mind. And that's how powerful trauma is. Collective trauma that's happening to a group of people is we can experience it by just by reading stuff or looking at videos. So it's important to address these things by continuing to maintain some kind of regimen that's focused on self-care. And I know self-care is like such a cliche thing, that term is thrown around so much. And when I'm talking about self-care, I'm really not talking about self-indulgence. I'm not talking about treat yourself all the time. I'm talking about making sure that you're sleeping well and keeping up with sleep hygiene. I think a lot of us staying at home are kind of in this dangerous world of really messing up a sleep schedule because we're not tied to a lot of the responsibilities that we have outside of our homes. I think it's important to maintain a healthy and balanced diet, whatever that looks like for your specific needs, like nourishing yourself with real food. Because if you're not feeling good on the inside, when it comes to like what you're consuming, it's definitely going to affect your mood too. Mm-hmm. Maintaining self-care is so important when we're experiencing all this vicarious trauma. And then you touched on this other thing that it's something that I've experienced as well, just being in different kinds of minority groups or marginalized people. It's this experience of like, okay, so do I speak up? Is it my responsibility to do something for everybody? Or on the other hand, it's like, it shouldn't be my burden to do this. Like, people of the dominant culture in the place that I am, they have all the access to the information. They should educate themselves. Like, why should that responsibility fall on me? So I don't know what the right answer or the right direction of action is supposed to be. But I think in all of these cases, like, we're allowed to feel whatever we're feeling right now. And I think doing the things that are in line with what you think are important in terms of your values are very important right now, because we want to keep living the lives that are important to us even while we're stuck at home.
Yeah, no, and I completely agree. I think it's hard to say if there's more harm than good maybe done with reposting some of these things that are just so hurtful and painful, especially when we're all self-isolating and it's hard for us to do anything but consume that media. Right. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I agree. It's like, limit the amount of information that you can take, and whatever you are feeling, Mel, especially for you right now too, it's like whatever you're feeling is super valid, and there's no need for you to constantly consume this just to feel like you have to, right? Mm-hmm. And I think everyone is feeling this sort of level of anxiety, especially for the unknown, when this is all going to end, things that we're reading in the news and all of that. Hey, Sue, and just in terms of like symptoms and mm-hmm. whether it's emotional or physical that someone listening right now might be feeling, when would it be the right time to maybe seek out help?
You know, as I mentioned earlier, and of course I'm going to be biased with this, it's like, it's never the wrong time. But I think when you're now experiencing some problems in your main areas of function, so what do I mean by that? It's like, for most of us, our main areas of function as adults are our jobs. But of course, if you're a student, it's going to be school. Mm-hmm. If you're a freelancer, it's like the work that you're doing. If this has been impaired in some way, like you can't function, that's probably a good indicator that you should talk to somebody. Again, if your relationships are suffering, these are the big things that I'm looking for most of the time, is like just your function in your main contexts of life, which is your job, your relationships with important people, and function out there. Like, if you're unable to function, then you probably want to talk to somebody so mm-hmm. it doesn't turn into a more serious issue. And when I say serious issue, of course, I think in the back of every therapist's mind is the most serious issue of someone contemplating ending their life because they can't think of or come up with any way to live anymore.
And is there potential that even if someone is not aware that they have been heavily emotionally impacted today, mm-hmm. that they might see signs like many months or even years down the road after a large scale traumatic incident like this?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's kind of a built-in coping mechanism sometimes to keep some of this stuff buried down deep inside, because you know you have to provide for people or there are others depending on you and you can't let yourself fall apart. I don't know how scientific this is, but like, I think of it like your immune system. I think a lot of people have experienced, like, once they finally get a vacation after an extended period of working, they get sick on the first day. And I think it's because your immune system and your body kind of knows, like, I don't have to keep it up anymore because I don't have to go to work today. And then now you get sick because it just lets go. I think our internal mechanisms when it comes to dealing with emotional and mental pain is kind of similar sometimes. You have to survive. So you go into this mode of continuing to get things done because you have to. I think a lot of people in the Asian American community too are raised with a lot of grit. And so it helps us, but it also helps us bury a lot of things that come out later, maybe years down the road, looking very ugly and like something else.
I guess one last question to sort of wrap up this segment. If I wanted to support someone who is emotionally affected, what are some ways that I can support them, or what's the best approach to supporting someone who might be going through just emotional trauma?
Another very hard question, because each person is going to respond to so many things differently. But generally speaking, it sounds like you're asking for somebody that you probably care about, right? And in that context, you probably know them. So if there's someone that oftentimes needs space, you can consider giving them the space that they need and just inviting them to come to you when they are ready and when they want to, just letting them know that you're there for them. Mm-hmm. If there's someone that needs company, you can make yourself present. I mean, it's hard to go over to your friend's house right now because that's not recommended or advised, but you can do things like video chat and staying connected through technology. People are doing a lot of stuff online. People, as in companies now, are creating a lot of products to help us stay connected online. So I definitely encourage folks to look into that stuff. I think it is kind of dangerous right now to tell your friends, like, everything is going to be fine, because that can be a little bit dismissive of someone's feelings, especially when they're feeling kind of hopeless, like, things are not going to be fine. I don't need to hear that. So I think when we instinctively do that or turn to some kind of, like, I don't know, like, cheesier affirmation, we're trying to help, but we're inadvertently trying to bury it or, like, diminish whatever this issue is. So that's one of the skills that a therapist will do. We will validate the concerns that our clients are bringing to us rather than trying to make the concerns go away by saying that they don't exist.
That makes me think of that scene from Inside Out where Bing Bong, like, loses all of his stuff. And I think the fairy person was just like, you know what? It's okay. Let's just go. It's fine. And then he, like, doesn't really feel anything from that. But then Sadness comes by and sits down next to him. And she's just like, I know how much that meant to you. And then he was like, yeah, it did mean a lot. He was like, you know what? I feel a little bit better now. Like, we can start going.
Yeah.
So that, like, that scene really does depict how it's important to not just be like, everything's going to be okay, but to really validate someone's feelings, I guess, when you're supporting them.
Yeah. I love that movie, by the way. And yeah, it speaks to how every emotional experience that we have is there for some reason. Yeah. We have our emotions to signal to us and communicate to us something. And then we have outward displays of these feelings because we are social creatures. This act of crying, it's a visible thing so that others know that you need comfort. Yeah, when sadness is there to validate the feelings of Bing Bong, it's important because Joy, the little fairy, she's like trying to make everything better by being happy all the time, but that's not real life. And that movie itself just communicates how each feeling is important in its own way, that expressing our sadness to others is how we're able to connect to and reach deeper levels of connection with those around that want to help you in times of distress.
Yeah. Awesome. So, hey, Sue, we've talked a bit around dealing with the worldwide issue of COVID-19. And you touched upon this a little bit, but now we are all, you know, social isolating, social distancing. And for a lot of our listeners, we have a lot of listeners in heavy, like, metropolitan areas. They're probably in pretty small, like, apartments, and many of them might be living alone. Mm-hmm. So do you have any additional tips for someone who is going to be social isolating alone in a small space, you know, for an unknown amount of time?
Oof, that is a tough one. But I think during a time like this, it's, like I said, really easy to let your sleeping schedule go, but it's also a lot easier to forget about basic hygiene when we're alone and there's kind of no social pressure or expectation to take care of that stuff. But letting all that stuff go will eventually lead to this like feeling of being a slob. And I think that's actually very deeply connected to depression, because these are the symptoms of depression, of just like letting all those things go. So willing yourself to continue brushing your teeth, you know, taking showers, doing your laundry, take care of your home is super important, right? It's like, even if nobody's observing or witnessing you at this time, it's important to continue taking care of yourself, to continue communicating to your body and your mind that you are someone that needs to be taken care of, that your self-worth is still there. Mm-hmm. I think those that suffer from depression and anxiety already, they do have inclinations to stay home and stop engaging in any kind of exciting activity already. And now that the world is not just giving us permission to do that, but instructions to stay home, I think the sense that we should be out and about doing something isn't there, because we're not supposed to be. And those that could really use something like that to motivate themselves to get out of the house and do something might struggle with this. So It becomes even more important, I think, to kind of visualize if that looks like writing it down. If you work well with like agendas, to-do lists, like somehow keeping yourself accountable to maintaining some structure in your life, I think that can be pretty powerful, just so that, you know, the 18 hours that you're awake don't fly by in the blink of an eye because you're just numbing yourself with whatever vice.
Mm-hmm. I think you mentioned previously, you said self-care isn't self-indulgent. What is the difference then? Because like, when I think of self-indulgent, like I like to binge watch Korean dramas. I'm like, is that considered self-care or self-indulgent?
Right. I think there's a fine line between like, you know, overindulging yourself and then really caring for yourself. So self-care to me, I have to first think about what it looks like to care for another person. When you're caring for another person, you often will probably go out of your way to do something for this other. Imagine someone that's super important to you. They call you at 3 a.m. and they say that they're stranded somewhere. Generally, we will get up out of the bed and go get them because this person's important. No second thoughts, mm-hmm. right? It's depending on who it is. But a lot of times we won't take that effort for ourselves for whatever reason. A lot of times we won't do this uncomfortable thing because it's best for us. For some reason, we don't prioritize ourselves. And I think that is common to a lot of different people, but especially for Asian American women, we're raised to do this because our moms do that. Our moms have done that for our dads and for us. Mm-hmm. We've seen this exemplary person of never really considering her own needs. And so I think we live in this strange limbo land of like doing that too, accommodating others and over accommodating in such a way that we don't have energy for ourselves. When I think of self-care, I'm thinking about going the extra mile and taking the extra effort to really be there for you, like me, right? Yeah. So that could feel like forcing yourself to exercise. You know, it might not be what you want to do right now, but it is best for you. It's the same thing for someone that you care deeply about and you see them going into this very sedentary lifestyle that's not good for them. You're probably going to encourage them or at least hint at some way that they should probably change their lifestyle a little bit. Same thing with food for someone that you care about deeply. You don't want to see them subsisting on like ice cream and Cheetos all the time. You want them to nourish themselves with real food. So it's the same for you. Stuff that tastes good in the moment and feels good in the moment. It feels good because we're being hit with this like dose of dopamine from our brain, but that's not in the long run going to be what maintains overall wellness and health. Mm-hmm. That fine line between self-care and self-indulgence too is looking at like using food as a treat for yourself. Like occasionally, great, whatever, in moderation. But once someone now is looking to food all the time as their source of happiness, that's when you can start developing disordered eating and a really unhealthy relationship with food, which is supposed to be something that helps us live. When it comes to binge watching TV, I think all of us sometimes really benefit from shutting down our brains and just consuming something passively where we don't have to do stuff. I think, however, once it's now consuming all of your time and you're not doing anything else, that's where it's a little bit unproductive for yourself. Like if you're letting go of relationships that are important to you because you'd rather watch TV for 8 hours a day every day, that's kind of, I think, the distinction.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that, Hesu. Well, I think that wraps our episode for today. Hesu, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you sharing your expertise in mental health with all of our listeners and also sharing with us your personal background. Would you like to let our listeners know where they might be able to find you online?
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor and a privilege to be able to talk on mental health to a community that is really near and dear to me because it's something I identify with. And in terms of the online space, I'm actually pretty private, so I'm not really on social media, but I do have a profile on BetterHelp's website, which is betterhelp.com/hesu-joe. Other than that, you know, if you're interested in online counseling, I would definitely encourage anyone to check out the website. If you have questions, you can always contact the support team. There's a contact page on the website, but you can also reach out by emailing contact@betterhelp.com, and somebody's going to be available to assist you with any questions you might have about the service, so you don't have to commit right away. You can kind of see if it's a good fit for you before making that choice.
We actually started partnering with BetterHelp recently. So if you are interested, as Hesu mentioned, you can go to betterhelp.com/ABG, and they're actually offering 10% off the first month to our listeners. So you can access the link in our show notes.
You can find us on all the podcasting platforms like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts. Subscribe and leave us a rating and review at Asian Boss Girl. And if you'd like to support us through monthly donations, you can do so at anchor.fm/AsianBossGirl/support.
And we are very active on social media. Our handle is @AsianBossGirl. Let us know you're listening by taking a screenshot on your phone, sharing on your IG story, and tagging us. You know, you can also include something that you learned from today from our special guest, Hesu, and we'll restore it on our own Instagram. And also, we have just launched our YouTube channel, so you can find us at Asian Boss Girl. We just released our New York City vlog.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much, Hesu. Till the next episode.
Bye.